one of the inherent tragedies I was exploring in the book is you can have the best intentions of wanting to live alone in the woods, but it's not going to work out well. We need other people in the same way that we need a deeper connection with nature.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Maxim Loskatov, or Max, about Old King. In the summer of 1976, Duane Ocean finds himself stranded in a remote Montana town, beset by a series of strange and menacing events. He takes a job as a logger and builds a cabin on an isolated road near a reclusive neighbor, a hermit named Ted Kaczynski. Old King is a novel that wrestles with the birth of the modern environmental movement in Montana, the accelerating dominion of technology in American life, and a new kind of violence that lives next door. Raised in small towns in the West, Maxim Loskatov is the critically acclaimed author of the novel Ruthie Fear and the short story collection Come West and See, both winners of the High Plains Book Award. His stories and essays have appeared in numerous periodicals, including the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Plowshares, and GQ. He is a Yaddo and McDowell Fellow. Other honors include the Nelson Algren Award, the M. Literary Prize, and the Montana Innovation Award. He lives in the Rocky Mountains of Western Montana. Max, thanks so much for being here. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren. It's so great to be here.
And I'm so glad to have you here. Max, the last time we spoke, it was December 2022, and we talked about your previous novel, Ruthie Fear, which had just won a Montana Arts Council Innovation Award. And in that conversation, you mentioned this book, Old King, that you were in the midst of writing a book set in the 70s when a sort of back-to-the-land ethic wasn't so politically fraught. And like your previous books, you're writing about the margins, the rural, the poor, the neglected, or the merely left alone. Why does that matter to you, to spotlight the margins of the West?
Because I feel like those are the stories that haven't been told. Growing up in Missoula, I had a great love for Montana literature, but it presented a world that was very different from what I saw in my elementary school and high school, which was a world that was very divided along class lines. There were really poor people who saw things such as the logging industry very differently from the families that had a little bit more wealth. And I think I took that in as a child, and it bothered me. And it sort of bothered me all the way through my adulthood, that there's this sense of the West as this place where our continuing evolution as human beings living in a landscape is sort of played out in our national imagination. But that story has been very one-sided, and places like Darby in the Bitterroot Valley, where Ruthie Fear was set, and Lincoln in the Blackfoot Valley, where Old King is set, are unfamiliar, I believe, to readers and a national audience.
Does writing about and within these marginal spaces, and in the case of Old King, about outsiders moving to Montana, invading these natural spaces, does that writing allow you to process the extreme and really rapid growth of our state in a way that's not pure anger and frustration?
Absolutely. You know, we all came from somewhere. That's sort of the continuing way that I look at it. And over my lifetime, I've seen so many different waves of interest in this state and of love of moving here. And it's interesting, the older I get, the easier it becomes to be resistant to it and to want Montana to stay the way it was. I think everybody creates sort of an idealized version of a place that existed when they were a kid. You know, I'm sure my dad has an idealized version that's much older than mine. And so I don't want to get caught in that, because what Montana represents to me is an entire species-wide need to reevaluate our relationship with the natural world. That's being played out here. The desire that people have to move to places like Montana to reconnect with nature is a noble one. It's one that goes back to the beginning of human history. But we're very much in the process of learning how to do that efficiently. And so much of what you see today in Montana is representative of that struggle.
The grace that you're talking about, that you're affording these outsiders, is both really apparent in this space, talking with you here today, and in the novel. And I want to bring in one of your central characters into this conversation. Ted Kaczynski is so much a part of this novel, and his rage can be read and felt in these pages that you allow him here. But your writing, its tone, doesn't really read as angry or frustrated. I'm curious, Max, why did you use Ted as the vehicle to write about a changing West?
Because Ted was the first person who taught me how other people see the West. I was 11 years old when he was caught, and up until then, Montana was just my home. The forest was just the forest, the rivers were the rivers, the lakes, and Missoula was just a town that felt very ordinary to me. But I have this very palpable memory of the days surrounding his capture, the feeling of the entire nation suddenly turning their attention to Montana, and suddenly becoming aware of how this place was seen, what it represented in the national imagination. The last best place to hide was the headline that kept popping up. And I realized that for the wider country, Montana was still seen as a frontier, a place people came to escape their lives and reinvent themselves, a place that you could get lost. And it was very jarring for me, because that wasn't my experience at all. It was a fairly suburban upbringing, you know. We went to the mustard seed, and so it was a really seminal moment in that I began to examine Montana in a different way after the story of Ted. And his story was so confusing to me as a child, because the layers that came out and the order in which they came out were so strange. There was a sense that he was in some way invested in the environmental movement. There was a sense that he was very smart and had gone to a good school. There was a sense also that he was a madman who had blown up computer rental stores for no reason. And so he remained this very complicated figure in my head who had changed the way I saw my own home. And so it felt very important to me. I think writing for me is often just a quest to understand people better. And he was someone who had gotten into my psyche at a very young age.
You mentioned this idea of Montana as a place to escape to, and you spoke to the idea of outsiders coming here because they want to get back to nature. How do you think about that tension between, yes, you want nature to be a place of reprieve and spiritual calm, but that seems to be placing nature in service of the human, which is so counter to the ethic that you're creating with your work. I guess my question is, do we want to consider nature as an escape?
I think that's a beautiful question, and it is really what I wrestled with in this book, is that the book is told from three viewpoints, and what unifies all three of these men is they all come to Montana looking to be saved in some way. And I think there is a sense that, you know, when we idealize nature and sort of set it apart from ourselves, it is always a paradox. You know, people move to Montana wanting a piece of the Wild West, and then they tame it and it's no longer the Wild West. And so as long as there is this sort of us and them relationship of like, oh, we're coming here to take a piece and to have it enact out a part of whatever this fantasy is for each individual, it's destined to end in a sort of tragedy, whether that tragedy is small and interior or much larger, like Ted's was for the entire country. I think the question as we go forward and we repeat these cycles of attracting new people is, how can we integrate them into the landscape? How can we learn how to integrate into the landscape in a way that isn't emphasizing a kind of separateness, but is emphasizing stewardship above all else?
I want to point to a part in your novel where you blur those boundaries, where you take that separateness and sort of throw it out the window. One of your central characters, Dwayne Ocean, has moved from Utah to Montana without much of a plan. He begins logging to sort of eke out a living in Lincoln. And in one scene, he's covered in sawdust and splinters and thinks that it was almost, quote, like he was becoming a tree himself. I loved that moment, this sort of blurring of bodies, and it seemed reminiscent of Ruthie Fear, of the more supernatural elements of that story. And Old King, at least in my reading, occupies a realist or a realistic space, but I'd be curious to know what you're leaning into in this particular moment.
For me, the title of Old King, which is, you know, can be interpreted a lot of ways and directly represents a certain ancient Douglas fir in the Blackfoot Valley. But for me, it comes from a much older idea of this nature as a character itself, as a force itself that's always in the background, that's always waiting to take us in. You know, when we die, inevitably we return to nature. There's no getting away from it. You can spend a few years fleetingly pretending you are, but there really isn't. And the suffering that so many of the characters go through in this book is because of that sense of separation. And these three men are all looking for moments like that. They're all desperate in different ways to be taken in by the natural world. And they idealize the characters, a couple characters in town who they see who are more connected with nature, but they're only able to hold it for these very fleeting moments, and these very complicated moments, like the one you reference, where Dwayne has just begun logging and he's literally covered in the detritus from the trees that he's been cutting down. But through that, he feels like he's become part of a tree for a moment. Again, it's not a feeling that is deep in his bone that he's able to hold, but he glimpses it.
One of the interesting things about this novel is that it deals in paradox. Dwayne comes to idealize Ted's solitude in the woods, living alone. And then because readers already know who Ted is, who he becomes, the Unabomber, we're asked to carry these conflicting ideas with us as we read, that there's something to both idealize and fear about Ted's solitude.
Exactly. And I think that's another, you know, part of the mythology of Montana that I internalized when I was 11, that it's taken me a long time to recognize and break free from, is this idea of the solitary, usually man, but person in the woods, that is it's a really powerful piece of our mythology that, oh, here in America, if things don't work out, you can just run off into the wild and live alone. We have a lot of these kinds of Kaczynski-esque stories. And really, that mythology is so ridiculous. There's no indigenous culture where people were living alone in the woods. There were rites of passage where people would go off alone for a very specific amount of time to connect with nature. But this idea of, oh, I'm just going to live alone in the woods and end up not going insane is comical, really. And so that is sort of one of the inherent tragedies I was exploring in the book, is you can have the best intentions of wanting to live alone in the woods, but it's not going to work out well. We need other people in the same way that we need a deeper connection with nature.
You're listening to A Conversation with Maxim Loskatov. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. Max, we've been talking about the philosophical and very real difficulties of turning to nature as an escape. I'm reminded of our previous conversation about Ruthie Fear, and in that conversation, I asked you what it meant to you to be a citizen of the American West. And I don't know if you remember what your answer to that question was, but I'm going to quote part of it back to you now. You said, "We are all citizens of the American West. And so for me, the question is, how can we evolve into that role? And how can we learn to live alongside the landscape rather than on top of it? And not just for the sake of the landscape, I think that our very spirits are at stake as well." Max, to my reading, Old King is so much about this. Not only our ever-changing citizenship in the West, especially here in Montana, but also about spirituality of place. Will you talk about the role that you've written for spirituality in this novel and perhaps how our changing and growing state has forced a change in the spiritual nature of this place as well?
Exactly. I think that, you know, there's a line in Old King with one of the characters who for me is sort of the heart of the book, who's this renegade veterinarian who's had to escape from Arizona because he kept getting in trouble with animal control because he rescues predators, particularly coyotes and wolves that have been poisoned, and nurses them back to health and sets them free. And so he's ended up in Lincoln running this illicit animal sanctuary. And another character is watching him help a wounded animal. And he realizes that for Hutch, wild animals are God, mm-hmm. that this is his church. And to me, that's what I aspire to as well. I mean, when I go into nature, I see God, whatever that means to you, spirit, all around me. And it changes everything in that moment because it removes the incredible anxiety and isolation that characterizes so many aspects of the competitive, dislocated modern world we've created, and returns us to a sense of belonging. And so I think I think that this story for everyone starts in their own heart and in that experience that you can have when you go into nature and you feel those barriers drop away. And what happened if you lived your whole life that way? And, you know, my books so far have mostly been tragedies because I think that the story of the 20th century was people being unable to do that. You know, I think we all, you know, even the most frightening among us, have an urge to have these kinds of true transcendent experiences of oneness with spirit and, you know, being a part of this planet. But we've created quite a trap for ourselves with the modern world. We've created so many layers of removal that it's something we glimpse but are unable to live in. And so, you know, I know that the practice for me is finding the places, the people, the experiences that give me that feeling and trying to hold on to it for longer and longer periods and listening, you know, to what I learn in those moments and what they can teach me about how to live. And if there's anything else that I would love for readers to seek out in my books or to come away from my books with, it is a new sense of possibility for their own relationship to the natural world.
Max, we've provided our listeners with a big context, this conversation about a new way, this possibility of living in the American West. Let's provide them then with a bit of narrative context. Would you mind reading an excerpt from Old King? Maybe the part in your story where another character, Mason, he goes looking for a bear who has attacked a camper in the Lincoln area.
Yes, I'd love to. The dusk was luminous. The full moon rising in the pink sky cast an iridescent glow, bringing out the glimmer of quartz in the cliff face below Ogden Mountain. Black smoke from a distant sawmill threaded upward like the exhalation of the earth's interior furnace. Vultures still circled the campground to the west, where the woman's body had been. Mason had tracked the bear for the entire day. In his guilt and hunger, the quest had taken on biblical proportions. He limped after his dog Molly through forests and across shadowed clearings, haunted by his past. The bear had not stopped and rested as he'd thought it would, as if it knew it needed to retreat deep into its territory. The distinctive tracks it left, the front paw favored, the dragging imprint slightly deeper, led around Ogden Mountain, keeping to the jack pines at the timberline, then descending through a draw on the far side of the ridge. The bear had stopped to drink at the mouth of Dead Man Creek, and Mason stopped also, sharing his jerky with Molly. Now night was closing in, and both man and dog were famished, exhausted, and cold. But Mason sensed the bear was close. He couldn't let it escape. His mistake had led to a woman's death. Shadows flickered in the periphery of his vision. He picked his way across a field of scree and paused to rest against the charred trunk of a lightning-struck pine. All around him, similar blackened spear trees were driven into the earth. Fingering the bark, he felt something soft and withdrew a tuft of warm brown fur. He tilted his head back and sniffed the air. He could smell the bear, a strong, musky, earthen scent. It had stopped here and rubbed its back. Mason knew he was in danger. The bear was tracking him just as surely as he was tracking it, but he wasn't afraid. He wondered what it would be like to be eaten, if at some point the pain would be replaced by curiosity, revelation. His only concern was for Molly, who watched him with glinting brown eyes, wondering why they weren't going home. "Soon," he said, patting her head, "I'm almost done." The woman's death had caused him to reevaluate his entire concept of right and wrong. By arresting poachers and running old trappers out of business, he'd cleared the way for rich tourists to build second homes around the old Mike Horse mine. They'd used easements for an 18-hole golf course at Smith Pond. Their contracting crews killed animals by the score with bulldozers, and the cement they poured left no way for the trees to grow back. They parked their fancy cars outside the Lincoln Hotel and walked beside the river at night. Their children fed deer. A sadness filled Mason that he could not shake, for the Montana he'd first come to 10 years before, with its trappers and speculators and violence at the Wilderness Bar every Friday night. When Mason turned, he saw the bear behind him, atop the scree field. It had flanked him and circled back, and now stood upright, watching him like a sentinel in the dusk. Smart, Mason thought, but it didn't matter. He had a gun. Slowly, he unslung the heavy rifle and braced the stock against his shoulder. The safety was ice cold, and it seemed to take a great amount of energy to click it off. In his exhaustion, he wasn't sure he could pull the trigger. The bear's golden fur shimmered in the moonlight. It shifted its weight, sniffing the air. The hump on its back seemed to grow. It was a magnificent, towering creature, and Mason felt the whispered memory of a time when human life was defined as prey, before houses and cars and high-caliber weapons. Cavemen raising flaming torches against saber-toothed tigers, sharpening sticks, learning to launch arrows, on and on until technology became a god of its own and all the predators were vanquished, leaving men to turn on themselves with napalm and nuclear bombs. But we're still prey, Mason thought, thinking of his mother, spending her days alone in the big house in Charlestown, the TV blaring, a slave to desire, shackled by commercials for new appliances and hi-fi equipment, afraid of all the things she might not have. He steadied the rifle, beginning to count down from 10, a tactic his uncle had taught him during their first hunting trips in Maine when he was a boy. Each number slowed his breath and focused his mind. He thought of all the pathways that had led to this moment, his disdain for his father, his love of the wild, his divorce. Pray, he thought, mouthing the word, shifting the interior vowel from E to A. He thought of the woman in the tent, how stunned she must have been that in the last half of the 20th century her life could end in such a way. He thought of the black wolf he'd saved, alone in the Bob Marshall wilderness, unknowingly transmitting its signal back to the receiver in his living room.
He wished he could snap his fingers and make the collar fall off its neck. Pray. Mason couldn't remember his last prayer. If he did now, it would be to the bear he was about to kill, this ancient giant at home in the unfeeling web of the universe. Mason's hands trembled. He peered through the scope. Magnified to fill his vision, the bear's eyes looked back into his, two golden pools, expectant, as if waiting for the debt of its life to be repaid.
Thank you. I don't know that my next question is a question you want to consider or that you considered while you were writing Old King, but in thinking about a character like Ted Kaczynski and thinking about this passage that you just read in particular about a human character searching out a bear who has attacked someone, I'm wondering, is retribution a part of this conversation or is it a consideration for you?
It's a question.
And,
it was a question for me with wrestling from the earliest stages of this book of how to write a character like Ted Kaczynski. And, you know, this book took me a very long time to write. And that was the reason. I couldn't figure out how to start writing a book about someone who'd done such terrible things without somehow making them the hero. Even if it was an anti-hero.
Right.
And so, and even if the satisfaction in the book came from watching the anti-hero get their comeuppance, I didn't want that to be the feeling that this book leaves the reader with. I didn't want the feeling to be, oh, he got what he deserved, or anyone got what they deserved. I want it to be much bigger than that, much richer than that. And so the way that I was able to get through that with Kaczynski's character in particular was by beginning each section of the book from the perspective of one of his victims and trying to, as the writer, sort of live in the experience of opening a bomb, of being an ordinary person going about your ordinary day when this complete stranger, a person you've never met, you've never heard of, suddenly destroys or deeply alters your life because of an ideology you'd don't even understand. And so through that process, I felt how ridiculous Kaczynski's own ideas of retribution were, that society had taken a wrong turn and technology had gotten out of control and scorned him. So he was going to kill someone who ran a computer rental store in Salt Lake City, you know, just a guy, or a secretary who happens to open her boss's mail at a university. Or a campus security guard who picks up a misaddressed package. And so the desire for retribution is very concrete and human, but I think it is always missing the bigger point.
That was novelist Maxime Loskatov, author of Old King, out now from W.W. Norton & Company. Look for more information about Max at mtpr.org. where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.